Our first experiment is going to be on the technique of extraction, something that you're going to use not in every single experiment, but quite a number of them. Extraction is used in the following situations. Imagine that you do a chemical reaction that produces more than one product, or it produces a product but a number of byproducts. We want to have some way of being able to target and isolate the one or sequence of compounds we really want to get out of a solution. And so there's ways that we could play solubility tricks to target a compound and extract it out of a solution. So to get to the technique of solution, we need to do a little background theory. We need to do a little review of molecular polarity, which we will do more in lecture when we get to molecules, but we get a little baby intro here. Polarity, that takes us into solubility, because again, it is tricks of solubility that we use in order to do extraction. We're not doing just a normal extraction in this lab. We're doing what's known as an acid-base extraction, where we use acid-base reactions to change polarity. So once we cover those topics, then we can get to extraction proper. We'll go over the procedure for this part A of the lab. You will not finish part A today. I'll give you a very clear designated point where to stop, but my lab lecture is going to exceed the normal lab lecture time for today. So you'll still have 3 more lab periods to finish this experiment, though. You'll have plenty of time. But again, you'll have a very clear cutoff point for where you need to reach today. And then before I let you start, there are some notes on chemical safety and handling that I want to make sure that we go over. So let's start with polarity first, and let's start with an example. CH3CH3, a simple 2-carbon hydrocarbon, has the name ethane. Eth is one of these common names that we still use, even though we now have a systematic nomenclature. It has, yes? I recommend you put it anywhere except for where you're going to actually do your lab. So where you wrote your pre-lab, I would make that only your lab book. It's not that I require it, it's just that someone from the other section already lost their lab book. But that's but not for these notes, that's more just for when we go back and put a table of contents. If you prefer to put it in your lab book, that's fine, but we'll, I'll also be collecting the lab books at some point. I just don't want you to be without your notes.
I just wanted to make sure we didn't
want to. No, you don't have to, and I recommend that you don't, in fact. So, ethane has a rounded molar mass of about 30 grams per mole. Then, in comparison, we'll have water, which has a molar mass of about 18 grams per mole. Now, even though ethane is the more massive molecule, it is a gas at room temperature. Water, the less massive molecule, is a liquid at room temperature. Why is this true? Why is the one that's heavier a gas, the one that's lighter a liquid?
That side of the room would like to volunteer.
Oh, fantastic. This side of the room? Yes.
Well, water is a polar molecule, so it has a lens structure, and
you're on the right track. These attractions, there's a term that I generally use, which is intermolecular forces. Intermolecular forces are electrostatic forces, meaning they involve plus and minus charges. And these attractive forces are what hold molecules together. And what you said is right. At room temperature, there's too much kinetic energy, too much thermal energy for water molecules to stay together as a solid. But because they do have these intermolecular forces, they do stick together as a liquid. Ethane, as we're about to see, has a nonpolar structure. And we'll talk about what polar and nonpolar means. because of that, it doesn't have as much of these intermolecular forces, so there's not as much to hold it together. So not only can it not stay together as a solid, but in fact it just goes completely flying apart and turns into a gas. So let's ease into this topic. First, this definition of intermolecular forces, not the International Monetary Fund. So these again are attractive electrostatic, which means involving plus and minus charges, and these are between molecules. We're going to talk about polarity, but what is the prime root cause of polarity? Electronegativity. So what is electronegativity? And what situation does that happen in?
Between a more electronegative matter and a less electronegative matter.
That are doing what? They're part of a... You totally got it. Bond.
Bond.
Right. So electronegativity is the tendency of an atom to pull electrons towards itself when it's part of a bond. If I were to make the same cartoonish picture of the periodic table, which ways along the periodic table does electronegativity increase? Yes, that way. So towards the right and up. Now we exclude the noble gases. Because they have octet configurations, they don't tend to bond. So we'll make our destination point here fluorine. Why is it that electronegativity increases towards the right and as you go up? Moving back to this side of the classroom, who would like to tackle either of those, either towards the right or as you go up? Yes? Right. To the nucleus. That's exactly right. As you have a smaller and smaller atom, those electrons are closer and closer to the nucleus, and the nucleus has a stronger and stronger effect. Why is it that as we go from left to right, we have this change?
When we get closer to having the valence electrons, it's easier to accept values.
That's right. That the closer you get to being an octet configuration, the easier it is to satisfy an atom by getting those electrons, and that translates into having higher electronegativity. So let me just throw this term out there because we're now there. A dipole, because this is what forms when you do have atoms in a bond that are of differing electronegativity. What is a dipole? It's not when they attract each other. Dipoles do cause the attraction, but what is a dipole itself?
It's when you have two poles, so two charges.
Right. Dipole means two poles, either north and south if we're talking about magnetism, or since we're going to confine ourselves just to talking about charge, it's going to mean plus and minus charge. Or I'll say it this way, a dipole is charge separation in space. So it has a plus and minus end. It's caused, or let me write this as a separate thought, bonds have dipoles when the atoms in a bond have different electronegativities. So when we do have a dipole, we can say that something is polar. And there's a couple of different ways that we can write a dipole. So if I have something like water, where yes, the whole molecule is polar, but each individual bond is also polar. One way to show that is to write an arrow. And this is not a mechanism arrow. You can tell the difference because of the plus sign that is part of that arrow. I got your email. Everything's fine. So the plus sign shows the element that is less electronegative, so it's having their electrons taken away. And then the tip of the arrow shows where the electrons are going towards. Since this is an arrow, though, this is highlighting the fact that dipoles are vector quantities. Which means you have a magnitude, the amount of charge separation, and then you also have which way that charge separation is being pointed towards. Another way of indicating this is by using a delta symbol. Writing a delta plus for the element that is slightly more positive, and delta minus for the element that is slightly more negative. Now, make sure that when you're writing these deltas that you don't confuse it with the letter sigma, which we will use later on when we talk about sigma bonds. So sigma is like a zero with a line coming off of it. A delta is more like a sloppily written D. And again, the delta in this case means a little bit. So a little bit positive, a little bit negative. Questions up to this point. So this tells us why bonds will be polar when we have these different electronegativities. But it doesn't therefore directly talk about why molecules are or are not polar. And let's look at an example molecule, carbon tetrachloride. Tetra means four, so carbon tetrachloride means the molecule CCl4. We write a structure for it. We could do it as follows. This one time I'm leaving lone pairs out just to simplify a bit. And you notice that I've used different kinds of lines to represent the molecule. You do not have to be able to use these right away, but very soon we will learn the meaning of this dash wedge system. So the wedge is this thicker looking line, and that represents something that's pointed out towards you. The dash represents something that's pointed away from you. So this is kind of a way to suggest three-dimensionality from this structure. Now, since this is carbon with four bonds, no lone pairs, what kind of shape does this molecule have? It's a tetrahedral shape, which we are going to have a review of Vesper theory next week, where we'll restudy just the shapes we care about for organic molecules. Because this molecule is tetrahedral, tetrahedral means having four sides, or having a shape that the sides, bonds, angles, everything is exactly equal. Well, then that means these dipoles from each of the bonds are also exactly balanced with each other. And so we end up in kind of a tug of war effect. Where to simplify, if we had a linear system where we have just two bonds, you can imagine that one bond is pulling one direction, but then the other bond is pulling exactly the opposite direction. If you have those two things that are exactly balanced with each other, it's as if electrons were never pulled anywhere. And so even though the bonds might be polar, the molecule as a whole is non-polar. That's true in this linear case. It's also true in a slightly more complicated situation like this, a tetrahedron that, again, has everything balanced. So although the bonds in this molecule may be polar, because the dipoles exactly balance each other, the molecule as a whole is nonpolar. So what could we say then must be true structurally about a molecule in order for it to be polar? Has to not cancel out. So can you think of a term that we could use, a geometric term? Non-symmetrical or asymmetrical. So a molecule must have some kind of asymmetry in its structure in order for it to be polar. So coming back to the ethane water example that I started out with, if we look at the shape of water, it's got two bonds and two lone pairs, which we can imagine that the lone pairs have their own space. And so this is a derivative shape of a tetrahedron because there's four things. But it can't be a tetrahedron because tetrahedron means four equal things. So what shape do we call this? It's bent. And because of its bent shape, that means it's asymmetric, and so it's polar. Because the bonds are really polar, and this is asymmetric, that's why water itself is really, really polar. So this is bent, and so therefore it's polar. Now what about ethane? Well, if you look at each carbon individually, it's almost, but not quite, a tetrahedron. In fact, you can imagine this as being two tetrahedra that somewhat overlap each other. But in general, if you have a hydrocarbon, even if it's not totally symmetric, they're normally nonpolar. Because the difference between a carbon-hydrogen and carbon-carbon bond is so small that especially on large molecules, any of these differences of electronegativity average out. In this specific case, even though there's this difference between the carbon-carbon and carbon-hydrogen bonds, the molecule, if you chop in the middle, is exactly symmetric with itself. So one half of the molecule, its dipole would cancel with the other half still, and so this is symmetric. And so it's nonpolar. And it looks like I didn't write it down earlier, but when I gave this example, we were talking about thermal energy, which is just kinetic energy. It's the fact that at any temperature, a temperature is due to the fact that molecules are wiggling around. So water is a liquid at room temperature because its intermolecular forces exceed the kinetic energy and keep the molecules together. Whereas because ethane is nonpolar, It doesn't have as much in the way of intermolecular forces, and so therefore it can only exist as a gas. Yeah. It would be tetrahedral if every position was exactly the same thing that was attached. And in fact, by having the lone pairs, it's only a minor deviation from being tetrahedral in terms of shape. 105 degree angle instead of 109. But even if it had exactly equal angles, the fact that you have a bond with an atom over here can't be balanced out by the lone pair that's on the other side. So even if shape-wise, it was exactly a tetrahedron, it still would be geometrically asymmetric.
And you also gave, for the two examples, the molecular mass.
Right.
Isn't that a certain point with hydrocarbons, if it's large enough, it can't be pretty powerful in terms of its ability to sort of stay together, because something is a gas but doesn't have the intermolecular forces isn't strong enough at a certain energy level, in this case with a room temperature. So if water is stronger, it holds itself together better because of that, so it's liquid. But at a certain point, there could be a hydrocarbon at room temperature that has enough molecular mass to equal or over have a greater attractive forces.
And that is due to what are called temporary dipoles. So everything we've discussed so far are permanent dipoles caused by structure. For large molecules, you can have momentary asymmetry caused by the molecule moving around. And so that temporarily generates a dipole, and on a large enough molecule, you have enough of those that occur at one instant that it can bring larger molecules together. So I guess I should clarify that everything we've talked about so far is for permanent dipoles. Temporary dipoles, when you have a large enough molecule, can accumulate and cause molecules to stick together, but if you're directly comparing one with the other, temporaries are much weaker. So whenever you have a permanent dipole, that's going to have a more dramatic effect. Right. So nonpolar because there's nothing for one molecule to grab onto the other molecule with. There's not this plus and minus distribution. Then that's why they're not able to stick together. So let me write down that comment I made about thermal energy, though. In fact, I'll just summarize it because we're going to come back in lab 3 days from now when we do melting points, and we'll talk more about phase behavior. So in this first case, we could just say the intermolecular forces are greater than kinetic energy. In this other case, the intermolecular forces are not able to overcome the effects of kinetic energy. Questions about polarity before we move on to the next topic? Then our next topic will be on solubility. To set up a discussion about solubility, could someone tell me what the two molecules, the two target molecules are today that we're using in our lab? Benzoic acid and naphthalene, that's right. And before we jump into solubility, let's figure out, of these two molecules, which one would you say is the least polar, if you had to guess? And why would you guess naphthalene? It's symmetric, and it's only got carbon and hydrogen. And again, carbon-carbon and carbon-hydrogen bonds are not normally different enough from each other to cause polarity. So yes, naphthalene is very non-polar. However, if you had to make a hard choice between polar and nonpolar, if you had to not say, well, it's a little bit this or that, which way would you classify benzoic acid?
Polar.
For those of you who took Chem 1B here and you did the benzoic acid extraction, does benzoic acid go into water? Not at room temperature, no. And so that's one piece of evidence that you could use to say that it's also nonpolar. Better said, though, it is very slightly polar. What's that? Well, let me ask. Why would it only be slightly polar? Yes. Okay, so it is slightly polar because it does have these carbon, oxygen, and oxygen, hydrogen bonds, which are a bit polar. But if we took the carboxylic acid as a substituent to benzene, so ignore this substituent, how many atoms are in the rest of this molecule? I've heard a couple different answers. Six, which is a common answer, but that's only looking at the carbons. How many hydrogens are attached? I think I heard someone say it. Five. Because at the position where you have the carboxylic acid, and you know, I'm so used to writing benzene, I got to be a little more careful how I do this. Make sure that my double bonds are clearly written. So at this juncture, we've got a double bond, a single bond, a single bond already, so there's not another hydrogen there. But every other position, as we saw in our examples on Tuesday, does have a hydrogen, and so there's 11 atoms there. Benzene being, therefore, the larger part of this molecule, and very nonpolar because it's symmetric, that outweighs the polarity of the functional group. So benzoic acid as a whole is nonpolar. Benzoic acid is nonpolar because the larger, very nonpolar benzene portion outweighs the polarity of the carboxylic acid. Yes?
Isn't it easier to have some sort of number? Because I know that when we do experiments having testing polarity, like some people go, oh, it's really, really, really polar, it's really polar, it's polar, it's slightly polar, it's minimally polar, it's non-polar. I mean, those
and there is a way to quantify it, and you can assign an intensity, a number to that dipole. And later on, when we start talking more about solvent effects in experiments, maybe we'll see some of those numbers. But I have in the past not made people memorize those types of numbers, and so that's why I generally avoid talking about them. But you can have I forget the unit of a measure of it. In fact, I think it's a deby. But there is a unit of measure that you can specify how strong a dipole is. Now, let's expand this to talk about, before we talk about why something is or is not soluble, we need some terminology. So let's tackle that first. Because we want to talk about making solutions. But what is a solution? Yes, but can you define it without using terms that have that sol word in it? The answer is a solution is a solute and a solvent. But how can we define the term solution without using those sol words? Yes? And what's the technical way of putting that? You're right. This is going all the way back to Chem 50. A solution is nothing more than a homogeneous mixture. Which, as you say, means that you have these components that are equally spread out throughout the solution. So if you zoom in on the molecular level, you can't tell one part of the solution from another. That's what a homogeneous mixture means. Now let's go ahead and define these terms, solvent and solute. What is the solvent? Yes. Okay, that is true, but a better way of putting it even would be to say it is the major component of the solution. Because if you have something like water and ethanol, both dissolve each other. Which one is the solvent then is which one is the one in greater quantity. So the solvent is the major component of a solution, which in the future I'm probably going to start abbreviating a solution like this, S-O-L-N. And then the solute would be the minor component. So solvent, solute, how about soluble? What does soluble mean? Yes. Able to form a solution with a particular solvent. Because you can say salt is soluble, yes, in water, but not in something like benzene. So soluble means able to form a solution with a particular solvent. Which that brings us to the last two terms that we have for today. Miscible, because we're talking about extractions, and extractions generally involve immiscible solvents. But if we're going to talk about immiscible, we should figure out what miscible means first. What does miscible mean? Dissolves. It's a little bit more than just that, though. It's the fact that two solvents will dissolve no matter what their proportions are. So as much or as little of each one that you've got, you're going to form a solution. So miscible means two solvents that form a solution regardless of proportions. The opposite of that would therefore be immiscible. Which means unable to mix. Miscible, mixable. You could think of it that way. Unable to mix regardless of the proportions. And it is, yes, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So for something like miscible, if you were to say that salt and water would be miscible, you can just dump like a ton of salt in a cup of water, and theoretically it would all...
But salt and water aren't miscible.
Right, but like, just in terms of like if they were, could we do something like that?
If theoretically, yes. If you had two substances that were miscible, then yes, no matter how much of one you throw into the other, they would form a solution. But therefore, miscible pairs are generally solvents. Things that are both liquids, so that the liquid could incorporate together. And the most common example of a miscible pair, water and ethanol. And in fact, they're so miscible that we cannot use normal distillation techniques to separate water and ethanol completely from each other. Now, what was that? Oh yes, miscibility. For extraction, we generally use, again, immiscible solvents. In fact, we usually use water and some kind of organic solvent. The two normally will form two layers, and then if you have a compound that's nonpolar, it's going to greatly prefer the organic phase, and if you have a compound that's polar, it's going to greatly prefer the water phase. Why don't we see a small selection of common organic solvents? Many of which you will use this quarter. A simple hydrocarbon solvent is hexane. But even more common than hexane is something called hexanes with an S. That is a mixture of hexane isomers. Which, what are isomers? Okay, they have the same molecular formula, but different connectivity, different geometry, something about their shape is different. So molecules with the same formula, but different structures. So hexanes is a mixture of different six carbon compounds. Another common solvent if we take a carboxylic acid and we replace the hydrogen of a carboxylic acid with some other kind of carbon-containing group, we make a functional group called an ester. Naming-wise, we do the same type of thing. If we were to cover up these two carbons over here, this looks like the ion acetate. This two-carbon group, if you have a two-carbon chain all by itself, we call that ethane, A-N-E. But when we add it onto something else, it becomes a substituent. And so the name changes a little bit. We drop the ane ending, and we add YL instead. So it becomes ethyl. So this compound has the name ethyl acetate. Considerably more polar than hexane because it's got this oxygen in the middle and the carbon-oxygen bond sticking off the side. In fact, if we have a small enough molecule, carbon-oxygen double bond can actually make a compound water-soluble, which the molecule acetone is. It is water-soluble. Now, how about some halogenated solvents, solvents that have halogens, chlorine, bromine, iodine, in them? One common one is CHCl3, which does anybody know the name of that? It's chloroform. And then there's CH2Cl2. Which has two names. The systematic name is dichloromethane. But the common name, which you saw in Chem 1B, is methylene chloride. There are a bunch of other solvents, but the last one I'll show you for now is the one that you're using today, which has a multitude of names. The common name, which is still the most frequently used name, is diethyl ether. An ether is a functional group where you have carbons on either side of an oxygen. But because this is so commonly used, sometimes the di is left off and it's just called ethyl ether, And in fact, it's even more frequently referred to as just ether. So in a lab, if someone says, could you go get the bottle of ether? 99.99% of the time, it means diethyl ether. Yes?
Chloroform is also a common name.
The systematic name would be trichloromethane. But that you don't see almost at all. Now, the last little thing, and then we're actually a little bit overdue for a break. And this question I'm about to ask, we'll get a much more satisfactory answer once we get later in the quarter we have a review of thermodynamics. But you know, there is a common saying that oil and water don't mix. Why? Why not, I should say. Yes? And so, yes, there's another way of saying it, which is like dissolves like. Polar dissolves polar, nonpolar dissolves nonpolar. But what's the underlying reason for that? That's actually the right answer. But can you? That's exactly the right answer, because what it really is entropy. See, water is a liquid, the molecules are all randomly arranged. But what happens to water when it freezes? It expands. It's got this hole in it, you could say. This is why you don't put glass bottles filled with aqueous solutions in the freezer. Because again, at room temperature, the molecules all move past each other. But unlike most substances on the planet, when water freezes, the molecules pull apart from each other. And it's because of the extreme polarity of water. They form, which I hate the term, hydrogen bonds, because it's not really a bond. But are these attractions that occur in this kind of situation where you have oxygen attached to, or you have hydrogen attached to oxygen, nitrogen, or fluorine. So because of the strong interaction, the molecules pull each other apart and make this space. In terms of entropy, is this a favorable or unfavorable process? Unfavorable, because anytime you make order in a system, effectively, it costs energy. I mean, think of two chalk erasers. If you take two chalk erasers and clap them together, chalk's not going to just sit there in a nice little pile. It's going to go every which way. To make the chalk come back together, you effectively have to add energy back in to organize. It's just like this lab. It takes hours to clean it. It takes seconds to make a huge mess of it. Well, something like that goes on when you try to force a non-polar substance into water, because water at room temperature would rather have this random arrangement. But when you push another molecule in, it's making its own space and therefore, in a way, organizing water. That's a negative entropy change, which in terms of Gibbs free energy means a positive energy change. Positive energy is not favorable. And so it doesn't happen. So, like dissolves like is going to be a good enough reason for us most of the time. But once we have that thermodynamic review, it is a better answer to say that's entropy, why polar and nonpolar substances don't mix. Now, next topic that we need to tackle is acid-base neutralization. So we are doing extraction today. Extraction does take advantage of differing solubilities of compounds in different solvents. But we're going to stack on top of that a chemical reaction. Because as we discussed earlier, benzoic acid itself is not terribly polar. So what if we end up in a situation where we have both benzoic acid and naphthalene together? They're both nonpolar. And so if you put them into a nonpolar solvent, it's going to be difficult to separate the two of them out from each other unless we just happen to have the magic combination of solvents. But there's another thing we could do, which is to take advantage of the fact that benzoic acid is an acid. It is an acid, in fact, with a pKa value of 4.2. Now, do you need to memorize pKa values? No, not yet. And usually we won't be memorizing for specific compounds, but functional groups we will learn pKa values for. And we'll get much more into pKa next quarter. What base are you using to neutralize benzoic acid with? Sodium hydroxide, that's right. So in this acid-base neutralization, hydroxide will give a pair of electrons to hydrogen. Hydrogen can only have one bond at a time, so the oxygen-hydrogen bond, single bond, on benzoic acid will break. And we'll end up with two compounds. We'll make a salt out of what used to be benzoic acid, and we call that sodium benzoate. So just like acetic acid goes to acetate, benzoic acid goes to benzoate. We, of course, also have water as a byproduct. Now, what does having a pKa of 4.2 mean for benzoic acid? It's what, I'm sorry? Right. Everything she said. So if you have a high Ka, which let's write some of these things down. First, pKa, it is defined as the negative base 10 log of Ka. Ka, in turn, for a monoprotic acid, we write an equilibrium constant like this. We show how many protons break off versus how much of the conjugate is left, and compare that to the non-disassociated acid. In fact, if we wanted to just conceptually make this fraction, it's how much of the acid dissociates versus how much of the acid does not dissociate. And yes, if you have a very large Ka value, something that's much greater than 1, that's going to mean that you have a pKa that's less than 0, and that's for something that has extensive dissociation. And we call those kinds of acids strong acids. Now, if you have a Ka that's much, much less than 1, which means a pKa that's much greater than 0, that means you have minimal dissociation. Which means that you have a weak acid. Now, benzoic acid, in comparison to hydrochloric acid, is called a weak acid because it doesn't dissociate all that much. Although, in organic terms, benzoic acid's fairly strong because it's somewhat unusual to have organic compounds with pKa's of 5 or under. And then, oh, that's right, there was one other statement made, which is correct, that the stronger an acid is, the weaker its conjugate base is. And we'll see some justification for that when we do our acid-base review and lecture in a few weeks. But now let me come back to give you a preview of that topic and rewrite this neutralization reaction, but focusing in not on mechanism, but on reactivity. Because I did tell you earlier that benzoic acid has a pKa of 4.2. Water has a pKa of 15.7. So out of the two compounds, benzoic acid and water, which is the stronger acid? The one with the smaller pKa. Smaller pKa because it's the negative log of Ka. Smaller pKa means larger Ka. And so benzoic acid is the stronger acid. Water is the weaker acid. From the sentence up above, the stronger the acid is, the weaker the conjugate is. And so that means the conjugate of benzoic acid, benzoate, is the weaker base. The conjugate of water is the stronger base. So, stronger acid reacting with stronger base, making weaker acid and weaker base. That's the way that reactions want to happen, because this would be equivalent to a equilibrium constant greater than 1. So this neutralization will occur. Now, what's the point of this neutralization? Well, benzoic acid, again, we said, is mostly nonpolar. One little point of interest, when you have boiling water, there's enough thermal energy that somehow it is able to dissolve benzoic acid. And so later when we talk about recrystallization, we'll come back to that idea that temperature can have an influence on solubility as well. But compare that to benzoate. Benzoate, it's a salt. And I know we didn't talk about permanent versus temporary dipoles, except for that little brief mention of them. But above any form of dipole, there's charge. When you have a real full charge, that's going to have the strongest intermolecular effect versus any dipoles that you might have. So even though benzene is the larger portion of this molecule, even though it's incredibly nonpolar, now you've got a full negative charge in the molecule, it becomes water-soluble. Well, that's a great thing for us, because if we have naphthalene and benzoic acid that are together in solution, and we want to be able to separate one from the other, we can target benzoic acid, change its polarity, get it to bump out into the aqueous layer. Later on, since this is just an acid-base reaction, which is a reversible reaction, we can react the benzoate with acid, make it benzoic acid again, make it nonpolar again, and it falls out of water. And that's exactly the trick that we're pulling in today's lab. So by neutralizing benzoic acid and forming an ion, we have now made it much more polar, and we're able to accomplish the separation. Now, just so I don't forget to introduce this terminology, because it's mentioned in the theory part of your lab, which I started to get on your cases about reading the lecture text this morning. How many people actually read the theory part of this experiment? A few more hands. Okay, so you got my warning about that. Those of you who didn't read it, it's not that tough. And don't fall behind for the lab quiz that'll be coming up later on in the quarter. So this terminology I want to introduce, one, there's this term hydrophilic, which means water-loving, which means water-soluble. There's then hydrophobic, water-fearing, which means not water-soluble. Once we get later on in the quarter, we'll start throwing similar terms, opposite terms, lipophilic and lipophobic, which means fat-loving and fat-hating, organic-loving and organic-hating. I bring these terms up partially because they're in your theory portion of the lab, but it's also related to this neutralization that we've just seen. Because instead of a relatively small molecule like benzoic acid, imagine that we have a really long molecule that's got a carboxylic acid group at the end. Well, if you make a salt of that carboxylic acid group, you've now got a polar portion of the molecule with this long, stringy non-polar portion of the molecule, and that's a soap. A soap. Detergent, surfactant, because the way that it works is that if you have grease, the soap molecules, the long stringy portions of it, end up combining with that grease and forms a little ball called a micelle. On the outside of that micelle, you have all these different polar groups that make that whole entity, that whole assembly, soluble in water. So you put soap into water, the grease bits all congregate together, but the outside of it makes it water-soluble, which is why you're able to wash away grease. Question?
Yeah, so I was going to ask you, so because you have a negative attached to the oxygen and
yes.
The sodium benzoate, you're saying that's the guy that's going to provide the covalent needed, so it's going to bring the acid-based reaction.
Exactly. But it is water soluble.
But end,
that is true. But that's how much more of importance that charge has over any kind of dipole interactions that you might have.
So
now, there does reach a point in water, though, where if you get enough of a soap, it will start forming phases in water. So it will self-assemble into liquid crystals, in fact. So then you'll get this organic water mixture. It'll hold the water, but it's got such a heavy organic component, like you're saying, that it will start forming a biphasic material. But let's save that for 12C, where we'll get much more into that. For now, let's get to the experiment, because we're running kind of low on time. So first, I forgot to bring it. So let me run out of the room real quick. This is the piece of equipment that you'll be using in the lab today. This is a separatory funnel. Separatory funnel, you notice, comes with this little piece of paper stuffing. And that's because this is a ground glass joint. And what can happen is if you do push this in too snugly, or if it stays for too long a period of time, this can end up getting frozen, it's called. It gets stuck in here. Now, for the brief period of time that you're going to be using it today, probably not going to be an issue. Because they will sit around for quite a while until the next lab uses it on Monday again, when you return this to the stock room, please make sure to take the little piece of paper that came with it, or a fresh one if you want, and stick that back in between, just again to make sure it's not frozen. By the way, if you need to store something in a container that's not a ground glass joint, or if you want to make sure that the joints don't freeze up when you're using your own equipment, there's a tube of grease over there. And just the tiniest little bit of grease if you get it on here, and then twist as you put this on, it'll make a seal, but the grease will also keep it from freezing. And for many of you, if you had brown around a lot of the ends of your glassware, it's from that grease. So anyway, separatory funnel, way it works is it's got this chamber with a valve on it. That valve, make sure that you check to make sure that the end of it is kind of snugly on there. As you use this, it can work itself loose, and you might get leaking out the back side of it. When the valve is turned so that the handle is perpendicular to the flow of liquid, that means it's closed. When you turn it so that it's parallel, that means that it's open and liquid's going to pour through it. Be sure before you start using it that you turn that perpendicular, because almost every quarter there's some poor person that forgets and all over the place, first day in lab, right? The way that you'll use this is you're going to put your mixture in, you're going to add your benzoic sodium hydroxide in, you're going to have two layers, and then you want to shake them to make sure that the layers fully interact with each other. Do not, as I did in undergrad, just put this on here and start shaking, because ether particularly can build up pressure because it is so volatile. And so don't, as I do, while the instructor was standing right next to me watching, have your cap go flying across the room because you have that buildup of pressure. Instead, make sure that when you use this, you hold the top of the separatory funnel, and you've also got your hand, therefore, holding the cap on here. Again, not too snugly, because you don't want it to freeze, but if you don't hold it, the pressure will build up, and it's going to leak out on you. Turn it upside down, shake it. But again, for ether, especially the first time, don't shake it for too long before you vent by turning it and opening it and then closing it. When you vent, don't have it pointed at you or someone else. I mention that because every quarter what happens, I can see people that have things boiling away in their beakers and such, and they're worried if they're doing it right, so they bring it right up to me and says, does this look okay? So just have some thought when you do that. So you're going to put everything in here. Again, when you first pour it in, make sure that you have this perpendicular so it doesn't flow out. Hold it from the top like this. Shake it, vent it, close. Shake, vent, close. Shake, vent, close. Upright it and allow the two layers to separate. Now in the future, you might have situations where the layers don't form very easily. And then we'll have techniques for getting around that. But for today's lab, you should see the two layers form very readily. When you need to drain out of here, take the cap off. Because if you're trying to drain liquid out without any air coming in, you're trying to make a vacuum. So take the top of it off to make sure that you're going to get flow out of here. If you carefully just barely turn these, you can get where you can get some control over how quickly the liquid does flow out. And so allow it to just turn it just a little bit if you're trying to drain one layer and not the other. For this first lab, you may have some concern. Ooh, how do I make sure I get just that one layer and don't let any of the top layer come through? If some of the top layer came through, it should still float, and so you could get a pipette to transfer it backwards again. Or if you didn't let enough flow through, again, you're just trying to be careful with the flow adjustment. But that's part of what you're doing today, is learning how to deal with liquids and with this separatory funnel. So now let me go back to writing what you're going to use now. And this is not the full procedure, but we're so low on time that we only have the time to do this much, which is the following. First, before that, all the quantities that you have written for your procedure, cut them in half. Now, I'll try to make sure in the future to give you more warning so you don't have to make a sudden switch in your lab book like that. But after reviewing, I had forgotten that we had decided as a department to do that for certain experiments because you don't really need the huge volumes in all the mini-scale procedures, but we don't want to go quite as small as the micro either. So to go in between, we're going to use the glassware as we would for the mini-scale procedure, but to save a little bit on the environment and a little bit on cost, cut all the quantities in half. So instead of 2 grams of your benzoic acid naphthalene mix, you're going to just use 1 gram. Instead of 30 milliliters of ether, you're going to use 15. But you take your benzoic acid and naphthalene mixture, and you dissolve it in ether, diethyl ether. Or the bottle, I think, just says ethyl ether. All three of those things are the same. The ether I'll put in the fume hood over here in H13. In fact, all the chemicals you should need today are in H13, unless we run out of ether, and then it will be over in the fridge. But if you grab a bottle of ether, please bring it up to me, because we need to put the date down that it was opened. Because ether, once it's exposed to oxygen, starts forming peroxides. And old ether bottles, because of a buildup of peroxides, explode spontaneously on shock, which we don't want. So these are brand new, fresh, been in the fridge, not a hazard, but then once it's open, I need to make sure I put that open date on it. Once you dissolve it up, you're going to then add it into your separatory funnel. And then you follow that up with your sodium hydroxide mixture. I believe your lab procedure says 2.5 molar sodium hydroxide. Is that correct? Use 3 molar instead. The 2.5 that we had in here was contaminated, so they whipped up a fresh batch of 3 molar. Once you add all those together, you're going to form 2 layers. Which layer is going to be on top? I don't know if it actually says in the procedure, but it is the one that is the less dense material. Which is less dense, water or ether? Ether. Most organic solvents, in fact, are less dense than water. The notable exceptions, many of the halogenated solvents. So if you did take Chem 1B here and you did a methylene chloride extraction, that methylene chloride would be on the bottom and water's on the top, but most organic extractions we do, water's on the bottom, organic is on the top. Since you will have already added your sodium hydroxide, the bottom layer will contain not just water, but the sodium benzoate that has already been neutralized. Then the top layer will contain the ether plus the unreacted naphthalene. Naphthalene has a pKa somewhere in the 30s, so hydroxide's not anywhere near strong enough to deprotonate it. You can deprotonate it, but you need something quite powerful. So, after you've mixed all this together, shake and vent. And then for today, the last step is to simply separate the 2 layers from each other. So the bottom layer will go into a beaker. Where eventually you're going to reacidify and filter. But we'll talk about both of those next time. If you wanted to add the acid, you could. But in fact, I recommend no, because thinking about it now, neither of the 2 sections was able to get out on time, even with the warnings I'm about to give you. So they were out 5 minutes late, but it just takes so long to get going and shut down in here, and that's part of what this first day is trying to show you. So don't even worry about the acid, but since you did your pre-labs, that's what we'll follow with this bottom layer. Then the top layer, you'll also then drain out and separate. And then that one you're going to eventually just evaporate. There is a technique for distillation, but it takes too long. We have a vacuum system here which will do the job for us, particularly for ether. Ether is easy to remove. Questions about this much of the procedure? Then let me talk about chemical safety and handling a little bit. Because you do have liquids that you're going to be storing. You can store those liquids in your own drawers. But for any liquid, you need to make sure that it is actually sealed up. Solids that are non-volatile. And you might think, wait, volatile solid? Well, it's possible because you can have sublimation. So solids that are non-volatile, you can leave those open. But for liquids, we have to seal them. You have beakers, which aren't really good for storing things. And some of you might be familiar with this stuff called parafilm, but ether will eat right through it. So you need to at least store it in an Erlenmeyer. Your Erlenmeyers are not ground glass joints. So you cannot use the glass stopper on an Erlenmeyer because it won't make a good seal. You can maybe use your blue stoppers, which if you use your blue stopper when you put it in, you can fold the sides of it down to help make an even better seal. Or if you don't think you're getting a good fit with that, then there are various rubber stoppers from the stock room that you can check out. So you'll have two Erlenmeyers I'm going to recommend that you're going to store the two different solutions in. Make sure to seal them. Once you've put the stopper on, you could use parafilm if you wanted to, which, in case you haven't seen parafilm before, let me just demonstrate that. Parafilm is kept in the little blue box over here. I got mad on the first section yesterday because I thought that someone had left behind just the paper backings to these, but as I'm discovering, over time, this paper backing kind of just gets stuck. So what someone recommended is just rip one quarter to start getting the paper off so you can peel that off. And then once you get it going, patience, how long does that take? There we go. Okay, so once you pull it off, it works a bit like saran wrap, if you're familiar with what that is. The way to use it, though, hold with one thumb on where you want to seal up and gently pull the stuff, because as you pull it, it becomes stickier. Gently wrap that around as you're pulling, on top of itself, and it will make a decent seal. But again, it's not good for trying to seal something up by itself. This is just a backup seal. So that's how to use the parafilm. Anything that we store, we have to label. Because, for example, if there was a fire, when the fire crews come in, they want to be able to identify, one, are the things they as humans need to worry about. I mean, walking into a chem environment that's on fire can be quite a scary thing. If they see something, one of your drawers that's on fire, if they open it up, they want to know quickly what it is. So you need to label each beaker with the contents of the beaker. You can't use formulas or symbols. You actually have to use the full name. Again, so that in an emergency situation, someone doesn't have to think what it is. They just read it, and they know what it is. So you need to put your name, the compound name, and then the date on each of the vials. So you have one for your aqueous layer, so you could say sodium benzoate and sodium hydroxide. And for the other one, you could say naphthalene and diethyl ether. Yes? There should actually be little labels in the toolkit. There's a little a small toolkit on top of the refrigerator there, and most of the classrooms, they keep labels in there. If there aren't any there, if you just take a container to the stock room, they'll give you a whole bunch. Or if that's too small, well, where'd it go? We used to have a multicolor set of tape just for labeling. If anybody needs or wants it, I can go try to see if we still have it somewhere. Now, the last thing I need to discuss is going to sound a bit harsh, but you'll understand after I say it why I'm saying it this way. Because Cleanliness in the laboratory is a constant struggle for us as instructors. And I know that most of you in here are very conscientious, and you're going to treat the lab space the way it should be treated, because this isn't any of our spaces. You're just here for a year. I'm going to be gone someday too, and this place maybe will still be here. So however we enter the lab, whatever condition it's in, we need to leave it in the same condition. And I'll tell you the sort of pet peeves I have in terms of cleanliness. The main one is actually where you're located right now, which is the balance area. Within seconds of a Chem 1A lab beginning to use a balance, it's like someone has spread powder all over the benchtop. Which, this is not Chem 1A, as I said multiple times on Tuesday. There's a compound that you'll use, we'll use it next quarter or 12C, one or both. Aluminum trichloride. Aluminum trichloride decomposes into hydrochloric acid. Now think about that. Decomposes into hydrochloric acid, which means it's even more reactive than hydrochloric acid in a sense. It's a solid powder. If you treat it the way that some of you might have treated it in Chem 1A, you would have left a whole bunch of it all over this balance, which means anybody walking around here is just breathing in hydrochloric acid. Because if you take a bottle of aluminum trichloride and wave pH paper over it, not even put it in, just wave it over it, bright pink instantly. That's how reactive the stuff is. So is it really a good idea that you're leaving the balance a mess like that when you don't know, without me telling you or reading the pre-labs, how hazardous all these chemicals are? Related to that is how you put chemicals back. Because as college students, I never have understood, and I'm not going to use that bottle because I got irritated yesterday doing that example. I haven't understood how college students think that this is appropriately closing the chemical bottle. And I know you might laugh at the way I'm presenting this, but again, pretend that this acetyl chloride, a compound that if you breathe it in, puts acetate groups on any open OH groups that might be on the inside of your lung linings, for example. Also decomposing and producing hydrochloric acid at the same time. So if you just come over and put this cap on top of here like this, not going to protect you at all. Even yesterday in lab, after having said all this, I walked past this balance at one point and saw a reagent bottle just left wide open. So that means less than an hour after I get on everybody's case, people aren't following the safety guidelines. Which is why, and this is one last amendment that I need to make to the syllabus, if I do come across, not just at the end of lab, when traditionally we panic and clean up, but during the lab, if I come over here and the balance room is an absolute mess, it will be zeros for everybody on the lab. Why? Because the only stick that I have to beat you around with is your brain. And the only consequence you can understand, besides your own health, I mean, remember, this is your own health, and if you don't care enough about the chemicals just be sitting there and contaminating you, then maybe you care about your grade. Now, why everybody? Because you might say, wait a minute, I'm not going to be making that mistake. I know, but I don't know who did it because I can't watch all 26 of you individually all the time. Having that threat out there, I don't also want you all to police each other, although if you see someone that's constantly making a mess, you don't need to go talk to them yourself. You can just come and tell me, and I have no problem explaining at length to someone about safety requirements. Or if the point came to where someone won't change their act, then I just drop them from the course. That's the other solution I can have. Now, have I had to take points off like that before? No, because most people get it when I tell them that way. But I have to just inform you that is going to be one of the class policies, that we can't have this kind of safety hazard as we see all the time in Chem 1, because this is not Chem 1. So please, you can see this balance room is, this balance area is reasonably clean. I think some of the crap that's here was from over the summer, where they didn't lift every single cord up and clean it up. So this to me is okay, acceptable. Spills are going to happen. I'm not going to get mad at spills, because you can't fight gravity, right? It's what you do about the spills that matter.
You all are not first-year students. You're second or third-year students. That means you're good enough that you've made it this far. Take the fact that you've got that talent and training and don't ruin it by acting like a kid and just making a sloppy mess of the lab area. Does everybody understand what I'm trying to communicate here? It's not like I'm looking to take points off, but I can't let you be sloppy and unprofessional in this lab environment. This also goes, by the way, for all the little things that are over in this tool area, because we have, for example, pH paper. In Chem 1A, the first lab, we do something with pH paper, little pieces of pink all over the place, particularly in the sinks, which is one of the first places the inspectors will look, not if, but when they come. Because De Anza and Foothill De Anza Community College District is under a 10-year scrutiny watch by the state attorney general, because charges actually were almost drawn up against some of the administrators in the district because of past violations. Now, we're now considered a model in the Silicon Valley because we've been under such close scrutiny that we do it better than practically anywhere else. You go to some other places, they don't do as well on secondary containment and all the things that we do now. Because we're under that scrutiny, that's the other reason you need to be so careful, so that we still have a chemistry program for you to finish your classes with. All right? So please, don't make a mess of the lab area. Please be careful, since I've mentioned secondary containment. Right away, both sections yesterday, see, I had mentioned how bases are kept on a different shelf even. So someone had pulled the sodium hydroxide that you needed for the lab and put it right next to the hydrochloric and sulfuric acid. Honest mistake, because you think, oh, here's a place to put it down. But again, I had already mentioned secondary containment that first day. So that for them was 2 days previous. But that means in 48 hours they'd already forgotten it, not even thinking what they're doing in lab. This is not Chem 1A. Because of this issue, if you want to, during the time that lab is in operation, leave the sodium hydroxide bottle here, I'll put it away and make sure it gets put away properly. That way you don't have to worry about it. But just be aware what you're doing. The last thing I'll say is that waste, the only waste bottle that I think that we need for today is for the sodium hydroxide, because we're not using the acid today. So there should be a bottle already labeled back there for this experiment. It should be labeled just as sodium hydroxide. So everything waste-wise that you generate should go into that bottle today. If the bottle gets full, if it gets within an inch of the top, let me know right away, because when they come and collect waste, they get really angry at us if we don't leave what's called headspace. Because if you have an absolutely full bottle, as soon as you start to squeeze and pick up that bottle, something can leak out of it. So we need to leave a little bit of gap of space. So I'll make a new one right away, but let me know that a new one needs to be made. Now here's the last potentially rude sounding thing, which is about ending the lab. This is partly for my benefit. It's not such a bad situation in this lab, because there's actually 20 minutes between this and the next lab. This, if they're still listening to this one, section one, they end at 10:10, lecture starts at 10:30. If they're even 5 minutes late out of lab, that's 10:15. I still gotta make sure that this place is shut down and secure. I have to go back to my office, pick up the microphones, shake off the three or four people that are trying to ask me questions as I'm walking, make my way down to lecture, set everything up, and make sure that at 10:30 on the dot, I'm starting to write things down. And so, but since this is mainly geared towards them, but I need to treat you all equally, the policy is that, not as a class this time, but you individually, for every minute that you're here past 2:10, it's 1 point off your lab report. Because the quarters, I used to not have that policy, 2:10 would roll by and people are still doing neutralizations, people are doing whatever they want to. I say, hey, you need to clean up, you need to get out of your lab. Okay. And they turn right back to do what they were doing, just blow me off. So 10 minutes later, I walk right up to them and say, I'm going to throw this away if you don't start cleaning up. And then they start cleaning up, but they're so fussy about the way they clean, they take another 20 minutes to finish cleaning. And so then I'm half an hour late. And I just can't have that. I will start warning you 20 minutes till.
Now, I told you the two other sections, even when I did that, they didn't get out on time. Because what you're going to learn today is how tough it is to clean up and label and do all that with everybody else in your way scrambling to get out of lab. So just be aware of your time, and that's, again, why you only need to get this far. Yes?
So you want us to finish cleaning up by 2:10?
That's right. You need to be able to walk out of the door, and I need to be able to shut it at 2:10. Because the stockroom people that work, they have classes too. So in fact, I have a student that is in section 2. He works the stockroom for section 1, and so he's sitting there watching the clock, making sure that they are all going to be done in time so that he doesn't miss lecture. That's part of what's going on as well. Much of our staff this quarter, in fact, is in one of these three sections. So be considerate to them as well. It's not even so much... For you all, it's not so much me. I have the time I could sit around a few extra minutes. But don't keep the stockroom staff afterwards like that. Now, that's enough talking. Let's go ahead and get to work.